John, thank you for making the time to visit this morning. I really appreciate it.
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I want to get in to talking about our public safety program and advice for learners in the program and people who should consider the program. But before I get to that, you've got a remarkable history and background, and I'd like to spend a little bit of time on it and talk about how you arrived at this place at Capella University and kind of what your career path has been. I think that's especially important. One of the themes of these podcasts as we talk to learners and faculty is kind of the diversity of people's careers and the nonlinear career paths that everybody seems to share. And you certainly fit that category. Would you talk a little bit about where you're from and what your educational journey was like and what your career has been like?
Sure. I like many people who got into the field of criminal justice, really never started out or considered it as a young person. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey in an urban environment. As luck would have it, I ended up growing up right next door to the chief of detectives for the police department, but really never gave it much thought. And like most young people in those days, I had lofty goals. Simply stated, I think what drew me eventually into criminal justice is that I wanted to make a difference in some way. You know, when we're younger, we all believe that our contribution can make the world a better place. And I was no different than many of my peers. And it's for me, it started out in the military service. In those days, entering the military was not an option. It was a foregone conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
There was an expectation that you served because of the military draft. And so I enlisted in the Air Force and became an air traffic controller and never really started even thinking about pursuing a career in criminal justice. But while I was in the service, I happened to take a class, an evening, you know, night school class at a local university on criminal law. And that began what I call my journey, where I became fascinated with the entire premise of law enforcement or doing things within the construct of the legal system. Not sure exactly what I'd do when I got out of the military, but over the course of that five-year period that I was on active duty, I ended up taking a few more classes and really became enthralled with the idea that maybe I could be either a police officer or investigator, but like many, was struck with the requirement that you often need experience to get in the field, but who's going to give you the chance to get that experience?
Yep.
So I had always admired my next-door neighbor, who was the chief of detectives, and I actually gave him a call and said, you know, Frank, do you really think that police work would be for me? And I know you haven't seen me since I was a kid, but... And he was actually the one who encouraged me. He said, you know, you won't know until you try.
Yep.
And so I started to apply to, while I was on active duty and coming up on my close of my enlistment, I made a decision that, A, I didn't want to be an air traffic controller in civilian life, and B, that I became so fascinated with criminal justice that I wanted to look at all of the options. So I literally set up a system on my kitchen table while I was in the military just to send out application forms and letters of interest.
Uh-huh.
And I sent them to over 80 police departments in the United States. I took out a road atlas, and every city that had a police department with 50,000 population or greater, I applied to it. And I spent literally 6 months sending out letters. And then in the return letters, I had not yet attained my first degree. So in the return letters, one of the things I was looking for and one of the questions I asked was, what are your educational benefits? Because in the late 60s, which is the time frame when I was doing this, in the late 60s, Criminal justice was a relatively new academic discipline,
mm-hmm.
and there weren't a lot of schools that were offering it at the time, but yet many of the police agencies were interested in sending their officers back to school.
Yep.
So, of course, I had the GI Bill to fund my college education, but I wanted to preserve that as much as I could, so I was asking the police agencies, what are your best benefits? And so the long and short of it is I ended up landing in Kansas City, joining the police department there, because at the time they had the highest starting salary and the highest educational benefit dollar of any police agency in the United States. And I applied and got in.
What was that experience like, starting out as an officer on the force in a new city? By the way, I'm from Kansas City. I love it. I think it's one of America's best cities. But what was that starting out beginning experience like?
To be honest, I was scared, but yet I was newly married. My bride was from the Midwest, and she assured me that Kansas City was a great place. And, you know, I basically just made a decision, this is what I'm going to try. Nothing has to be forever.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll always, if I don't try it, then I'll always wonder, did I do the right thing? So I jumped with both feet and signed up, flew out there, took my polygraph, did all the prerequisite things that you have to do before you can become a police officer, and then went to the police academy for, I think it was 20 weeks at the time.
How long did that experience last as a police officer in Kansas City?
I was there 3 years, and then an opportunity came along to become a federal agent, and I took it. My grandfather had been a federal agent for 43 years with the U.S. Customs Service, and even though he had died before I was born, I had read all of his diaries and all his adventures of, you know, opium raids and seizing Chinese boats and all of these things in New York City. He was a federal agent in New York City.
Oh, so wow.
He was involved in what were then the turn of the century in the early 1900s were the opium wars that were going on in New York City.
Fascinating. I bet that's a heck of a memoir.
Yeah, I grew up with his stories, and because he died before I was born, I actually read all 43 years of his diaries.
Wow.
And, of course, he died on the job just after an opium raid in 1943. So I never got to know him. But
wow.
I had his stories, and, of course, my mother told me countless stories of his adventures.
How long were you a federal agent for?
25 years, and then in addition, had my 5 years of active duty. So I retired with 30 years of total service. And I retired as the special agent in charge for my grandfather's old agency, the U.S. Customs.
You're kidding.
No.
So after 25 years, looking back, what did you take away? What did you learn from and in packed into that 25 years is a really diverse set of experiences. But what did you walk away with?
I think what I walked away with was, even though I was a kid who grew up in an urban environment just outside of New York City, and, you know, I grew up in the era of, you know, splashy newspaper accounts of organized crime in the so-called underworld. And, you know, I never really knew a victim of a violent crime. So when I became first a police officer and then later as a federal agent, I guess the one thing that really surprised me the most, and was a real lesson to learn, was the fact that the drastic difference between good and evil in the what I call the human continuum, if you will, it's very broad. On one end, you have the explicit depravity of hardened killers,
mm-hmm.
and the likes of those who would abuse children or women or whatever else, while on the other end you have wonderful people who strive daily to live within the lines of justice, and how many of them are willing to stand up and help a fellow human being when they witness some type of wrongdoing. And despite over being in this business for over four decades now, I'm still awestruck with people who are private citizens who would risk their own life to help a complete stranger in need.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, knowing the difference and seeing the difference, despite the fact that you'd like to think about the darker moments and just kind of cast them aside, you really need those darker moments to contrast it with what some people are willing to do to help their fellow human beings. And that really, to me, sums up how important it is to have a strong public safety or a law enforcement or criminal justice system.
That's a hell of a good answer.
Thanks.
So there's kind of two streams running through your career. The first one, we've talked a lot about criminal justice and public safety. But the other one is distance education and the potential for distance learning and what it holds. Talk about your passion for merging those two and some of the things that we're doing in our public safety programs at Capella.
Okay. First of all, let me say I'm very, very passionate about the need for all criminal justice professionals to pursue higher education. And my career, I think, is typical of what many people in the field go through. When you first, when I entered law enforcement in the late 1960s, I was faced with an environment where education, as opposed to training, was very different and almost looked down upon.
Mm-hmm.
And education at the time was not overly embraced. You know, the typical response you'd hear from most of the senior police officers, for instance, when I started was, you know, I didn't go to college. I graduated the School of Hard Knocks.
Yeah.
You know, or something to that effect. And yet, despite all of my training and how good the training was, I also was in a great position as a rookie and as a young officer, especially on the police department, looking around and seeing, you know, the guys who are getting ahead are the unique ones at the time.
Yep.
Who had a degree. And even our chief at the time, Clarence Kelly, was a former FBI agent who had, you know, obviously a bachelor's degree, and I think Clarence even had more than that later on. And, of course, and then he went on, after he left the police department, to become the director of the FBI under a new administration.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned early on that, and actually had one mentor who was a former employee of the Central Intelligence Agency, said he was working his second career after I had become a federal agent, and he said to me, one thing that no one can take away from you is what you have in your head.
Yep.
And if you get an education, you're checking that block so no one can find an excuse not to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
And his name was Del Henley, and Del's remarks stuck with me. And even though I got into the federal service without a degree, I only had a couple of years of college, I was one of the 1% of federal agents at the time. In those days, 1% of the federal population could be non-degreed personnel.
Oh.
And I was lucky enough to get in under that rule.
Wow.
And then as I went through my career, it was interesting. I found people that didn't even realize that I didn't have a degree. And in fact, I moved up through the ranks, and I ultimately became a manager and then an executive, and actually served on the national headquarters staff and was an advisor to the Attorney General and had these other positions. And I once had someone ask me, he was a lawyer and he was one of the deputy attorney generals of the United States, And he said to me, he said, Sully, he said, where'd you get your law degree? And I turned to him and I said, Rob, I don't have a law degree. I didn't elaborate by saying I don't even have a bachelor's degree. I just said, I don't have my law degree. He said, I didn't know that. And the reason he asked me that question is I had been involved in a project where we were rewriting legislation for crimes against children, which later became the Child Protection Act of 1986. But I realized at that moment that I needed to complete my education, needed to expand my education, despite the fact that I had attained positions of power and had very prestigious positions. I didn't meet up to and have the official validation of a formal degree.
Mm-hmm.
So when I finished my executive tour in Washington, and I was given my first field command, and I was special agent in charge in the Fort Lauderdale, Florida area, and I had the time and opportunity to go back to school. So I went back to school and finished at a typical brick-and-mortar institution, finished my bachelor's degree. Within 2 weeks of that, enrolled in what they were calling a new theory of education that was remote learning is what they called it at the time, with the oldest teachers' college in America, National Lewis University in Chicago. And we actually flew in for two-week trips. And I was lucky enough to get into the government program where the federal government paid half of my tuition. And all I had to pay was the other half plus my books. But I didn't have to take vacation time or anything. They allowed me to work while I was on the job, fly up every 2 weeks for these 2 weeks of classes, and in a period of 18 months earned my master's degree. And then a friend of mine from Washington called and he said, I know you've been talking about dabbling in a PhD. He said, there's this new school that's just being formed, and I really think they might be what you're after. And I said, really? What's it called? He said, the Graduate School of America.
Hmm.
I said, really? And I said, can you send me the literature? And he said, sure. So he had looked into it as a possible route for himself, sent me the literature. And so I called the guy who was listed in the literature, and I ended up talking to him probably for the first time for about an hour. And then I called back a couple of weeks later, and I talked to him again. And long story short, over a six-month period, probably talked to him a total of 20 hours. The guy had patience of a saint.
Huh.
And told me all about this new school.
Sure.
And the fact that there were practitioners involved. And one of the things that made me select TGSA, which then became Capella University, was the fact that I knew one of the founders, and Harold Abel.
You're kidding.
And Harold, no, I had met Harold Abel in Washington, D.C.,
wow,
because he was an educator at the time for a university in Michigan that had a remote office in Washington, D.C., and they specialized basically in helping people at the Pentagon earn advanced degrees. And I had met Harold, really respected him, really thought he was an innovative kind of guy to have in the education realm. And because he was involved, I applied to six different doctoral programs, was accepted at all six, but I chose TGSA because they were, I thought, the most innovative, and they really believed in practitioner-based education, they calling it scholar-practitioner work.
Yep.
And that's what made me a believer, and so I enrolled in the program, and over the course of the next three and a half years, earned my PhD with what became Capella University, and I was in the second graduating class at Capella. And ever since, I've been a very strong proponent for Capella because, A, it gave me the tools that I needed to succeed. It gave me the tools I needed to validate my career.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, it demonstrated to me that you can advance your own personal education while at the same time advancing your own career.
Yep.
The two really go hand in hand. And that was a value that they cherished then back in the mid-90s, and they still, I believe, cherish it today, that if you're willing to do the work and you're willing to learn and you're willing to stretch for that next level of personal attainment and validation, that it's possible. And so that's why I'm such a strong proponent.
John, take me through this. Put yourself in the shoes of someone who is today where you were all those years ago. I don't know how many they were, but sitting at your table fresh out of the service and sending out 6 months' worth of letters to law enforcement agencies. We've got so many people coming out of the service today looking to reintegrate and trying to find the right path for them, whether it's professionally or educationally or both. What questions should they be asking themselves, and what should they be thinking about?
My best advice would be, first of all, let me say that I think that every one of us at some level have some, at least one, if not more, core interests. Some people might be interested in science. Others might be interested in psychology. Others yet might be interested in some form of technology or medicine or accounting or engineering. Whatever it may be, we all have at least one core interest that kind of catches our fascination to say, gee, I'd like to know more about that.
Mm-hmm.
And often that sometimes is what leads us to our first degree, the bachelor's degree. And yet a lot of people will say, well, what can I do? For instance, a lot of people said to me initially, well, you don't have, my bachelor's degree is in behavioral science. Has nothing to do, according to a couple of the police people that I talked to initially, said, has nothing to do with law enforcement. And my response was, I disagree. Having been in law enforcement, I believe that behavioral science has everything to do with law enforcement because yep. it's criminal behavior that allows our profession to be needed. And I said, it's what we identify psychologically as criminal behavior. So I disagree. What I mean by all of this is that our law enforcement is so diverse. Our criminal justice system is so diverse. Whether you're in criminal investigations, whether you are in corrections, whether you're in community service work, whatever aspect, you know, I've been asked many times, well, how many professions are tied to criminal justice? And I would speculate there are at least hundreds of very different jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And there are numerous options regardless of your central life interest. There again, whether it's science, technology, medicine, whatever. And then when you can get into it, the beauty of a criminal justice career is that it's compatible with almost any central academic discipline.
Yeah.
And it provides limitless employment opportunities, and basically you have to use your imagination to find it. I'll give you a good example. A young lady who is the daughter of one of my associates came to me about 6 or 8 months ago. She was finishing up college, and she said, Dr. Sullivan, I really want to get into something involved in criminal justice, but I don't think I want to carry a gun. I don't think I want that responsibility, especially in light of all the negativity in the news, et cetera, tied mm-hmm. to deadly force.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, that's understandable. I said, what are some of your strongest attributes that you learned about yourself from college? And she rattled off half a dozen things, but the common thread that I saw in the things that she rattled off, she had an analytical mind. I said, I quizzed her a little, and I said, if you had these two types of contrasting activities, which one would you choose? And I went through 6 or 8 different activities,
mm-hmm.
and it came back to one thing, that she liked analytical work. I said, do you ever think about being a criminal intelligence analyst? She said, what is that? I said, that's a job where you analyze bits and pieces. You're like a puzzle maker almost. You're taking bits and pieces of information from very diverse ranges and plugging them into one central area to see if you can identify a trend. And, you know, everybody thinks of trends now, they think of Twitter. But it's, you think of trends, think about criminal trends.
Yeah.
Somebody has to be plugging those together to make it viable for criminal investigators to efficiently follow up leads. One of the fastest growing fields in criminal justice is criminal intelligence analysis or crime analysis. And you don't have to carry a gun, you don't have to put yourself in harm's way, but yet you contribute to the overall mission of law enforcement in remarkable ways. That's just one example of hundreds that exist out there. And so what I often tell people is that first study yourself and decide what it is that makes you feel good about getting up in the morning. And then once you figure that out, then decide what is it that's going to make you really happy to go to work. I once had a senior agent, and it's a much repeated piece of advice from mentor after mentor, but they always say that if you love doing your job, you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah.
And that's really true, I think. For me, it's been true. I've been in this over four decades now, in this profession, and still look forward to going to work, still look forward to getting that phone call saying, Sully, can you help with this or help with that? And I think that's possible when you best prepare yourself with a good educational foundation. And then it's like one of the mentors told me, no one can find an excuse not to hire you.
Yep.
When you're prepared.
Let me add one last question. You've been really generous with your time.
Sure.
For that Capella learner who's already in their program and they're fighting to get through and completed and they're balancing work and they're balancing life with their degree program, what advice would you give them as somebody who's successfully managed that balance himself and has watched countless others go through that?
I think the thing that I would stress the most is be real about how you balance the work life, the family life, the academic life. Because when you're merging just your personal life and your work life, that's difficult enough.
Yep.
But then when you factor in the educational life, it becomes a compounding issue. And yet, at the same time, you have to frequently step back. And what I mean by frequently is at least once a month, step back from that and say, I am doing this because. And it may be you're doing it to advance your career. You may be doing it to find a very specific job. You may be doing it for a host of reasons. But the reality is you're really doing it to enhance your own self-worth.
Yep.
I think, for me, and I speak from experience, having entered a profession that required a degree, I didn't have it, but I went back to school and did what I had to do to get my degrees and to validate my experience. But when it's all said and done, the biggest gift that I gave myself was that I had the courage to invest in myself.
Mm-hmm.
I had the courage to take out that academic loan, to pay for prices that I thought then were exorbitant, but yet I look back on it now, and the return on my investment has been amazingly 10 or 20-fold, mm-hmm. at least.
Mm-hmm.
Because, but aside from the money, what I got for myself was validation that, you know what, I did it my way. I did it in ways that maybe my parents couldn't understand at the time. You know, I didn't go right off to college. I went off to the military instead. I made all these decisions. We live with the consequences of our decisions. But that doesn't mean that we have to accept the bad things when they come along or the not-so-happy things. You just kind of let it roll off and then get refocused. And I think the way to refocus is stepping back once a month and saying, even if you take a little legal pad and you draw two columns, the pros and cons, if you're honest with yourself and you look at why do I stay in this program versus why do I quit, I think you're going to have more pros for staying. And so the advice I give to people is be realistic in your expectations of yourself. If you see family challenges coming up or work challenges coming up and you want to enroll in two courses, but realistically you know in your heart of hearts, I should really only enroll in one. Yeah, that's going to have financial aid impact, but you have to look at yourself in each individual case-by-case basis and say, I need to do what's right for me so that I survive this program. And I think Capella's got the right idea with things like FlexPath and other things where they offer opportunities to be creative in your scheduling and to manage life events. When I was teaching for Capella, I used to put a little announcement out to my students, out to my learners every quarter. And it was entitled, When Life Intervenes.
Mm-hmm.
And what I meant by that was, when life intervenes, learn to manage it, but don't give up.
Yep.
Don't change your dream because you're being challenged. That's what being in higher education is all about, is challenging yourself and then meeting the needs of the future by getting prepared now.
Sully, this has been great. Before we recorded this, and I think we're going to post these out of sequence, but before we recorded this, I did a 40-minute conversation with our university president, Scott Kinney, and we were talking about what the parts of the job that make him the happiest, and he was talking about our faculty and the diversity of our scholar practitioners and their passion and their professionalism and how much they invest in our learners. And it's, you know, to hear him say that and then come off of that into this conversation with you has just been tremendous. You're an example of that, and we're really proud of the work you and the team in our public safety program are doing. And I just really appreciate you taking the time to visit with me today.
Well, I've really enjoyed it, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my experiences with other learners.
Awesome. John, have a great afternoon. Thank you.
You do the same. Take care.